Welcome to the Vortex Nation podcast, brought to you by lovers of hunting, shooting, public lands, the Second Amendment, and good food. All right, everybody. If you're listening right now, we are on the cusp of November. We're at the very tail end of October. And for a lot of folks, that means it is time to rifle hunt mule deer. If you live out west, oftentimes I'd say that's the species that you may be most passionate about. If you live in the east and you don't get out west too often, you're probably dreaming about mule deer, and you might be heading out for your first western hunt this year. Whether you are or you're not, we're sitting down with a good friend of Vortex, good friend of mine, Mr. Jason Matzinger, host of the TV show Into High Country, content creator extraordinaire, making all sorts of different conservation-oriented, great video productions. Jason, welcome. Really excited to talk with you about kind of like this latter season, late season, rut timing, rifle mule deer stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. It's like you say, we're right on the edge right now. I'm actually been out this morning kind of seeing what the mule deer are doing, and it's not quite happening yet, but you can tell that some things have changed since September, that's for sure.
For sure. So, you know, I'm going to back up a sec. So I know I introduced you, but like if you can give the listeners a brief rundown about kind of who you are, what you got going on, because I know you can certainly do a better job with that than I can.
Yeah, to give you a background to who I am, I was born and raised in Bozeman, Montana. I've been doing the television show. This is our 12th season now of doing the show Into High Country. We kind of specialize in Western big game hunting, doing a lot of the same hunts I've been doing since I was a little boy where I grew up hunting. And we focus on trying to tell the story of the heritage, the tradition, and the conservation behind hunting. So besides the television show, my biggest passion is doing the short films and the conservation documentaries through like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Wild Sheep Foundation, and Mule Deer Foundation are a few that I work with every year to try to help tell their story. You know, conservation is obviously something we as hunters understand, you know, how all of this is funded, but it's not easy for people outside of hunting to understand that hunting animals is helping animals. So I really like tackling those hard to tell stories that we want to get outside of our circle here.
Yeah. And from the outside in, from a non-hunter's perspective, I can see where for them there could be like a disconnect. It's like, you like to hunt. Yes, you're passionate about, chasing the animals. And in the end, at times, you know, if you're lucky, you kill one of these animals. Yes. You care a lot about these animals, even though you're killing them. Yes. You know, I think for some people, like that's like a tricky thing to like overcome mentally.
It is. Yeah. And it's hard for hunters to explain, too. It's not a one sentence answer. It takes a deep understanding of the whole circle of life, so to speak, and how it works and how everything is connected. And so, yeah, that's my goal, is to try to just tell the story of the work that these conservation organizations are doing and have done so well for so long.
No, I mean, and yeah, you do a phenomenal job at that. So if anybody's listening, I guess, you know, plug for Jason and his films, go check that out. I know when I watch them, number one, I always enjoy them. I always learn at least one or two things. And oftentimes I'm like, that's what I wanted to say, you know? So anyway, you do a great job at that. But aside from all that good stuff, Jason, like you said, you are essentially mule deer hunting right now. We pulled you away from hopefully not a big buck today. But you're talking about, you know, it's we're tail end of October. You're like, there's definitely changes happening. I guess, what do you see going on kind of like right now? And then what do you anticipate happening here in the next couple weeks as far as what the deer are doing, where you might find them, how they're behaving?
So right now, you know, basically what I'm seeing is those bucks just aren't hanging in those same areas they were in September. They're no longer on those early season patterns. They've started to transition. We've had some snowfall. We've had some frost, some things that signal winter's coming. So we're finding those mule deer bucks a little more spread out, not as congregated on those, you know, greener pastures, so to speak. But they're definitely not with the does yet. You know, I'm seeing big groups, 5-10 does that don't have any bucks with them. But then, you know, sitting there picking apart the hills, seeing solo bucks kind of cruising in some of those transition areas where I wasn't seeing them a month ago. So you can tell that those bucks are kind of positioning themselves closer to where the does are hanging, but you know, I haven't seen any lip curling or any chasing, anything like that quite yet. So that's kind of where we're at right now. So really I'm just hanging where I'm finding deer and then spending a lot of time behind the spotter, just glassing those shady hillsides. You know, even though there's frost in the mornings, those bucks still don't want to bed in the sun. So really, really looking at those shady hillsides and just trying to find an antler sticking out or whatever. Not a lot of time in the morning and evening that these bucks are going to be on their feet. So you've got to be out there in gray light trying to find them going to their bed. And otherwise, you're just looking for them to maybe stand up and move to, you know, where the shade is shifted to in the middle of the day. It's still pretty tough, I think, in a lot of areas to find those big deer where I hunt up here, you know, in Montana. But I think, you know, in the next week and a half, I would say in a week and a half, we'll definitely start seeing some of those deer come out of the woodwork that we haven't seen yet and start showing up, hanging a lot closer to those does and really coming out of those hidey holes that they've been living in all year. And, you know, with all the rifle hunting pressure, whether you hunt public or private, there's pressure everywhere. So these animals are getting pushed around and, you know, any morning you can wake up and go to the spot you've been hunting all year, this time of year, and see a deer that blows your mind that you just haven't seen all season. So I think that's what we'll be seeing in the next week and a half or so, is those better bucks we've been looking for starting to show up right tight to the does and letting their guard down a little more.
For sure. You know, I mean, hearing you talk about that and you see that kind of happen, whether it's even, you know, whitetails or mule deer, you wonder, where did these things come from? Like even Graham in the office this morning, he's got a couple cameras out. And, you know, on a property that he hunts very, very consistently, he's had cameras out there all year monitoring the place. And he got a picture of a deer this morning, never seen it before, never seen it alive in person, never had it on one of his cameras before. And it's just like, where materialize out of nowhere. And all of a sudden these, you know, these big mature deer that who knows where they were hiding, because they were hiding and they're really right. Good at it. But they can just kind of come out of the woodwork somewhere. And this time of year is a great time to capitalize on that.
For sure. Yeah, it makes you wonder, you know, how many times you glassed right over the top of them or maybe drove right past them or walked right past them or something where they were just hunkered down. Because they definitely, I mean, they've been there somewhere. But this is an exciting time of year because, yeah, you don't know what's going to show up. So,
and then, you know,
you just have to be there and see what happens.
Yep. And now you were talking about, you know, kind of spotting these doe groups as the season progresses a little bit and we get into November. Is that going to be a focus of yours then? Just finding deer, finding doe groups? And is that kind of like if you find the does, you'll find the bucks type of scenario?
Pretty much. Yeah. From the second week of November on, like the end of the second week of November on, right to the end of November, that would be my focus, is just finding the doe groups, finding the most deer I can find. Because, you know, if you spend enough time around those deer, you're going to see a mature deer cruising through them at some point. Plus, it gets cold. You know, you get a lot of snow, it gets cold. The deer are having to move all day. They're not just bedding down all day like they are this time of year. So, yeah, I mean, those deer are just going to be cruising from doe group to doe group, trying to find a doe that's, you know, in heat, and they won't really stop until they do, especially when it's colder and they'll just stay on their feet all day.
Mm-hmm. What does, you know, you're talking about the deer moving quite a bit that time of year. What does your strategy look like? Are you finding a good vantage and staying put and relying on those deer to move into view? Or are you doing kind of like a stick and move, like getting to a spot, you know, glassing it and either, you know, confirming, yeah, this is a place where I want to sit, or there is a deer that I want to go after, or it's worth sticking around because there's a ton of does here? Or are you like checking this going, you know, I'm not finding a buck here, I'm going to go over here and check a different spot?
Yeah, I guess it kind of depends. I mean, if I am glassing into a basin and I'm seeing like a lot of rut activities, bucks chasing, you know, the does acting squirrely, new bucks coming and going, kind of moving throughout the basin, then I'd be more apt to just sit and see what shows up. You know, I feel like that's kind of your magic circle right there that you're looking for, is that little rut frenzy. And if there is a mature buck in the area and you can keep eyes on that, what's going on there? Yeah, I mean, you got a good a chance there having a good buck show up when you kind of are positioned on them and they don't know you're there versus moving around. So that can be good. But I mean, if I'm seeing does even that time of year and there's not bucks chasing them, they're just not acting like they're squirrely, they're just kind of feeding, being lackadaisical, then I'll move on, you know, because they're, chances are there is a group somewhere not too far away that's got more action going on, and they probably have this nucleus of bucks moving around them.
Gotcha. With the bucks moving, like the beautiful thing is they're visible, you know, they're exposing themselves, they're moving, you can find them. If you spot a buck that is kind of doing all those things, but maybe he's like a mile or two away, how much can you depend on that buck being there when you get over there, potentially within shooting range? Or is that just a gamble that you're taking?
Yeah, it's a gamble. I mean, if he's on does and you look over there and he's 2 miles away on a side hill and he's just in the does and he's got his head laid back and he's displaying and doing everything and lip curling, you know, he's probably going to be there when you get there. But if you're looking out across this big sage flat and there's, you know, a few does clear over here and a few does clear up on this side hill, and you look out in the middle and there's just a buck moving through the sage, to go right at him is probably a pretty futile effort. I mean, you're better off to go, okay, he's headed this direction, either like that's the closest cover or that's the closest, you know, doe group, or that's the closest drainage he might drop into, you know, reading the terrain as well as maybe what other deer are in the area and going, okay, we need to get to there, because chances are he's going to go try to get across that flat and get into that drainage as quick as he can. You know, he doesn't want to be exposed. So you can use the terrain to kind of get out ahead of them. But yeah, kind of reading the animals. If they're content in a group, just sort of like standing guard, looking for other bucks, I mean, they're not going to be far. But yeah, if he's a cruising buck, you definitely got to get out ahead of him.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find, you know, a buck that's just, he's bedded with a bunch of does and they're just kind of hanging out, relaxing together?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Midday, you know, once everything kind of winds down, the sun gets into the sky a little higher and gets a little more intense. Yeah. You'll see them bedded out on those side hills, just laying with those doe groups for sure. And a lot of times they won't lay right tight with them. So I think a mistake a lot of people can make is like, especially those mature bucks, the young bucks will lay tight with them a lot of times. But I think a mistake people can make is looking over the does and being like, okay, just a small buck or just a few does, and then moving on, where 40, 50 yards away up on the side hill, tucked tight, is the buck that's laying with them. But a lot of times, you know, even though those does are super visible and there is a buck with them, you still got to really pick apart that stuff. And it's incredible. Like, you'll see one deer and then you'll see another deer, and then you'll be like, okay, I'm going to put the spotter on them instead of just the binoculars. And then you put the spotter on them and you're like, oh, there's actually four deer. And then, oh, five deer, six. Oh, there's way more to the left. And then it just, all of a sudden, it's like, wow, there's way more deer than I thought. And you know, that second week of November, anytime in there, I mean, good chance there's a buck laying somewhere in that 100-yard radius.
Right.
Just tight,
Yeah, like you were talking about earlier, some, you know, you got this group of deer, like you said, somewhere, you know, you got the bait, essentially, you know, that's somewhere around there, there's probably a buck, you know, and it's funny what you described just a touch earlier. I was hunting mule deer, oh, this is several years ago, and we spotted what I thought was actually almost like the reverse of that, a lone bedded buck. And just kind of where we were on our hill and where he was, all I could see was just like his head and horns. And he was kind of just bedded, you know, just kind of over the lip of a hill there. And I'm like, okay, we'll wait for him to get up. And we're watching the clock. And I've probably told this story before, even on the podcast. But, you know, and it's kind of getting towards shooting time. And I'm like, man, we might have to, like, you know, try and get this deer up. Like, he's not standing. So, you know, we make some soft grunts, you know, a couple whistles, and then just like slowly escalating the situation to where finally my buddy that I was hunting with like stood up and he's like, you know, hey, you know, well, the deer finally he doesn't care even about that, which I was shocking. And he wasn't like a giant, super crazy old mature deer, but he was like probably like, you know, like a 3-year-old 4-point, you know, like a nice buck. Mm-hmm. And so I go, well, I guess we'll just try and wait him out. Well, eventually he did get up and I shot him. But below him, like probably, you know, I don't know, but I'm assuming at least 50 yards below him, he had five does that were bedded below him that we couldn't see. And like looking back, it's like, oh, that's why you wouldn't leave. You know, that's why you didn't want to get up. Like he had, you know, a bunch of does with him and he was just like, yeah, that's my girls. And, you know, that's kind of what I'm doing right now. So, which also brings up a point of, these deer can be more, you know, we're talking about earlier in the season where like tough to find, hiding out, super skittish, a little bit more vulnerable this time of year with their mindset. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, once that rut kicks in, I mean, the does don't change their pattern. You know, they just continue to go where there's the best feed, the best water, and the best cover. And so they don't go into hiding. They just continue to do what they're doing. But it forces those bucks who have been hiding to come to them in those areas where they are a little more vulnerable. And so, yeah, I mean, if a buck is going to rut and he's feeling it, that's what he has to do. And a lot of times that brings them right out into the open and there for a week and a half. Those bucks you don't see the whole rest of the year do some stupid stuff. I mean, they'll stand right next to county roads on public property at daylight, you know, places you would have never caught them before. You can catch them and you can kill these big mature bucks because they're thinking about one thing and property lines, cover, terrain, all of that goes out the window. It's beeline one doe group to the next, or if he catches a scent, he's just on it. And there's not much that gets between that. And so it's a great time to capitalize on finding those mature bucks in places that you can get to them.
I like it. What about, you know, we're talking about, you know, the weather changes here. Is there a specific weather pattern or are there conditions where you're like, I have to hunt this day? Like this is a day where I can kill a deer.
You know, I think there isn't just one particular weather, but if I had to pick one, you know, it would be just a little bit of snow, so you're still able to get around, fresh snow, so you can really see those tracks when the sun starts to hit it. You know what's fresh. There's no question in your mind what's a fresh track, what's an old track. The deer are real visible, a little bit of breeze to help with sound and movement in the timber and things like that. You know, I mean, I think hunters, ideally, you'd like it to be dead still because it's feels the best to be out there, but I think the best hunting conditions, you need some wind in there to help you. And then overcast, just cold overcast and a little bit of breezy. The deer hate to be in that bright sunlight, you know, and so they'll avoid it at all costs, which puts them into the shadows, which makes them, you know, a lot tougher to see. So on overcast days, they're more apt to be on their feet. If it's cold out, they're more apt to be on their feet. And then just that wind factor keeps them a little more on edge and helps you if you do locate a buck, you know, get in tight without him hearing you or maybe seeing that movement because tree branches are wiggling and you can just get away with a lot more. So if I had to pick a day, it would be in the teens, between 0 to 20, 15 degrees, and fresh little snow layer, and a little bit of wind.
Man, you're getting me pumped to get outside. What about you? You're talking about, maybe it's not the most comfortable for you, or, what's comfortable for the deer. You know, a big part of being able to hunt, these later seasons is being comfortable. I mean, that is what allows you to stay outside for extended periods of time. What does kind of like your apparel system look like? What are your go-to pieces for that? How are you layering up, layering down, depending on the conditions, time of day? What do you always have with you no matter what?
Well, I mean, I'm always going to start with like a merino wool type base layer or some sort of base layer. And then, I'm a big fan of Sitka gear. So I almost wear their Timberline pant year round. It's just a bombproof pant. It's got reinforced knees. It's got the reinforced hind end, so you can sit down in the cold or the frozen dirt or kneel in it. It's got knee pads. It's got all the elements for changing seasons that I need. And then from there, if it starts getting colder, I'll just put a heavyweight base layer on over my lightweight base layer, kind of put two different layers of base under my Timberlines. And then, normally the core top, core heavyweight. I love the like Fanatic hoodie that they have. And then like the Jetstream jacket. I would say the one thing I never really leave without, although it was kind of a waste packing around most of this year, was rain gear. Things can change super fast out here. And I feel like, you can go through temperature fluctuations pretty easy just by starting to walk and sitting and things like that out here. But if you get wet, if you get drenched, if you get to the point of just sort of no return, like you can't really fight it off. You just get to a point of miserable and you get a chill you can't get rid of. And so staying dry is, a big part of what might keep you out there a little bit longer, getting through that storm that may last 2 hours and be there when it breaks, when things are really on their feet, instead of back at camp with everything hung up around the fire, trying to get it dried out. But I'm a big fan of letting my glass do the walking out here. I mean, every area is different. If you're hunting real mountainous timbered country, you can't, use a side-by-side or your truck to kind of get to different vantage points that you can hike to within 5-10 minutes to really cover a huge area for an hour at a time. I mean, you're having to just be straight on your feet the whole time, but out in the breaks, out in the Badlands country, I mean, you can see there's roads all through it, all through the public, all through the private. You can drive through the BLM, a lot of places. I get asked a lot, like, how many 10-mile hikes do you take while you're deer hunting? Well, none, unless it's like at the farthest end of a corner of public that you can get to and then back, because there's roads close enough in a lot of this stuff. So my whole thing is just using the glass, finding deer, and then going from there. So a lot of times I'll dress light in the mornings because I may end up in the truck for half a day bouncing around, just being like, okay, there's hunters here, there's no deer here, there's a few deer here but no hunters, and then being like, okay, here's where we need to go. So not every morning starts out with just trailhead strapping up, bombing in for the day. A lot of times it's just in the vehicle, just figuring out where in the heck the majority of the deer are and where I should really focus my efforts, so when I do put boots in the dirt, it's in an area where I got a chance of running into deer.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, being able to stick, move, be mobile, like you may not be doing like a 10-mile hike, but you might be doing a lot of 1-mile hikes, just to peek into stuff. And
oh, for sure.
That's enough to you just got to go where they are and go find them. So, I mean, I think that is definitely a really, really good strategy. Getting back to your rain gear piece, I just want to back up a second there. I think I'm personally scarred from growing up hunting Western Washington. Like my first 25 years of hunting was all essentially Western Washington. So, but the rain gear thing, like you said, like that could be a really big difference maker. And there's so many good lightweight, like high quality lightweight sets of rain gear that it's not a crazy penalty to, I mean, it's going to, you know, hit your pocketbook, I guess, on the front end, but like, it's not a giant weight penalty. It's not a giant space penalty in your pack, but it would potentially be a difference maker. So, I mean, like, I'm probably like overly whatever with it. Like, I'll be like, oh yeah, we're hunting Arizona for coos deer. Like, I better have a lightweight set of rain gear with me. But, I think that's a really good point. And I'll back up. And then this is were any of those pieces in your kit a puffy jacket, Jason?
Well, late season, I actually had a puffy on this morning.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's like my security blanket. I love the puffy. We talk about that a lot. You're talking about glassing. You know, we're kind of on the on the kit side of things. What's your go-to glassing kit look like for this hunt? From you know, binocular, spotter, rangefinder, range finding bino, whatever. What do you got in your optics arsenal there?
So I have the Razor HD 10x42s. Super small, lightweight, but you know, I like a 10x42 glass. I'm not a guy that's grown up with binoculars on a tripod. I've actually never really ever done that. So if I'm going to go to a tripod scenario and I'm going to bust out the, you know, that setup, I'm going to go with the Big Dog, which is the big angled 80mm, you know, Razor spotter. I love a angled spotter. I know, you know, more old school guys like my dad and his friends have a heck of a time getting used to the angled feature to it. But, you know, once you do, it just saves so much neck fatigue and shoulder fatigue. And, you know, you can literally sit in one spot with your eye in one spot and see from straight, you know, far to your left to straight far to your right and not have to shift this position right here. And any little bit you can do to save on fatigue and kind of stay in behind the glass, it helps, especially like I was talking about trying to pick apart this stuff for muleys, but I spend probably my most time behind the glass in spring bear season, just grid glass on those hillsides. And so not only are you behind your glass for 5-6 hours at a time, but it's hills that are like up here, you know, so you're not having to like get in behind it. You can still keep your head straight this way with your, you know, the lens up this way. And so, yeah, I mean, those are my two absolute go-to pieces for sure.
Deadly combination for sure. And like you said, when you're glassing for those extended periods of time, you know, just that fatigue of having to hold your body in potentially like an awkward position or something like that really can come into play. And like we're talking about before, it's all these little things that are going to keep you out there, you know, more comfortable, hunting harder, glassing harder, mentally in the game to hopefully capitalize on that opportunity when it comes up or when you earn it.
I was actually just talking to some buddies yesterday about that, and I was hunting with a friend trying to help him get an elk, and we set up the spotter, and he was looking at me and he goes, "Are you looking through the spotting scope right now?" Because, and I know a lot of people do this, but he found it bizarre, but I've trained myself to spot with both eyes open through the big spotter.
Oh, okay.
Because I found that if I close this eye, same thing, like you end up getting headaches and it, you know, end up doing weird stuff, try to keep that eye squinted, and it just kind of wears and tears on you after a while, unless you have like an eye patch you can put on or something like that. But through the years, I've just trained myself to look through the spotter with both eyes open. And when I look through, I mean, it just automatically goes into my right eye, and this just, I don't see anything out of it. And so he was asking me why I do that. And that's another thing, just way less fatigue and kind of headaches and things when you're spending a lot of time behind the glass.
For sure. This will be my, maybe not this year, we're well into the season. Don't need to make any last minute changes, Jason, but I will challenge you to glass with your binos off the tripod, because I know personally that changed my glassing life forevermore. So that's my... That's my challenge to you, because again, it's all those same things, right? It's being able to, and we talk about tripod glassing all the time here, but you know, just fatigue of, you know, like you don't have to worry about the one eye open thing. And you can be so still, depending on, you know, what magnification, you know, you got a big wide field of view. It's easier to spot movement because you're not moving. There's no arm fatigue because you're not holding the binoculars anymore. And you can just sit there and relax and, you know, glass your brains out. And it's a very glorious thing. And a lot of those things translate over to exactly what you were talking about with the spotting scope on the tripod with both eyes open. But yeah, very, very cool stuff there.
Well, the wide field of view thing, though, I could see that. That would definitely come in clutch at times. Be able to have that high magnification, but seeing a wider field of view, that would definitely be sweet. Yeah, I could see that.
You know,
gonna have to give it a shot.
I'm not trying to. You've shot a hell of a lot more mule deer than I have, so I'm not. You know, trying to be the the student teaching the master here. But yeah, man, gosh, I do love it. What about? I've seen a couple guys do it on the YouTube. Very popular in the whitetail world. Have you ever tried any sort of calling for mule deer?
You know, I never really have. I saw that question on there and got to thinking, I never really have. I've never really just went in with the notion that that's what I was going to do. And to your point, I have seen it successful, and I have, you know, we've called in some doe groups and things like just messing around, but never really with purpose. I feel like, yeah, it's one of those things. It's like blind calling bears, you know, like I know it works. And if you're not seeing a bear, then what difference does it make? Like blow on the call. But I have this weird thing in my head that's like, well, but what if? I mean, because right now they don't even know I'm here at all.
Right.
So if a buck is going to step out or a bear is going to step out, I'm not forcing him to fight or flight. Like I'll just let things play out as they're going to. So I know it works, and I wish I had the notion to try it more, but I'm always hesitant to call when I don't have to. That's for elk, turkey, bear, deer, like anything. I like to just not have the animals know I'm there as much as possible. But that could hurt me at times. I've seen it work, and it looks like it'd be a rush.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I think it could come into play if that I wouldn't just like do it for the sake of doing it. It would have to be like a specific situation where it's just, they're like, yep, this is either going to happen or it's not. And we need this deer to be over here, not over there. And it could be like, you know, something to have in the back of your bag of tricks, but not necessarily your go-to if you didn't feel like you had to do it.
No, it makes sense. I mean, if you've got a big old buck laying right up against a property line or something, whether he's on your side or the other side, I mean, you want to get that space. So, you know, it might be one of those like, well, he's already going to go that way anyway. It's worth giving it a try, or he's about to jump the fence or something, you know, then why not? I mean,
yeah,
you know, at that point you got nothing to lose. So not a bad idea.
In general, like you were talking about, just like calling in general, it's like you are gaining something, right? Because you're creating, you're making that vocalization, you're catching their attention, they potentially might come in because they did hear that. But you're also, like you said, you're giving something up at the same time. Like you've given up your position. Now they are completely focused on your location. Now they might want to be more inclined to circle downwind potentially to, you know, see, you know, who or what made that sound.
Totally.
So, yeah, it's always there's always a little bit of give and take there.
Yeah.
What about is there a weirdest thing you've seen a mule deer do that you're like, man, I have not seen that before?
Yeah, I do. So this one is a super easy question for me. So right out of high school, I used to guide elk and mule deer hunters in the mountains outside of Bozeman, little north of Bozeman, and we had a deer hunter there one time that I was guiding that hit a mule deer that is an incredible, one of the coolest mule deer I've ever seen in my life. It was a 10 by 10 non-typical that was 34 inches wide and has 10 inch double drop tines. Like the thing is crazy cool deer. And he hit this deer and he hit it high shoulder, like enough to really, you know, seriously injure the deer, but not enough to just put him right down. So we ended up on the blood trail of this deer with this guy that has emphysema really, really bad. He's probably 72 years old from Pennsylvania. Now we're in the mountains of Montana. So there's the elevation thing. He's older. He also has asthma, emphysema really bad. And in Montana, I mean, you can't discharge the other hunter's animal or anything like that. So it's like, there's no other option. We have to track this deer down. I have to get this guy that's in not the best shape on this thing. So we get on this deer's track. And luckily, we had that fresh snowfall, easy to follow his track, you know, and the wind hadn't blown yet. So even the tree limbs, like little thin pine branches, had like a layer of snow on it, you know, so you could see a lot of detail in the snow. So we ended up on this blood trail, and it had snowed enough to like cover the ground, but not underneath like big pine trees. It would still leave this big area of, you know, bare dirt under big pine trees. So we're tracking this deer, and we kind of go through some thick new growth pine, and we come under this pine tree, and it's bare. And so we just kind of walk through the bare spot and go to come out the other side, and there's no track out the other side. And so we're like, okay, you know, we must have missed something. So we just kind of circled the edge of that circle thinking, well, maybe he turned left or turned right or whatever. And we could not find a track coming out. So then we kind of made like a bigger circle around thinking, well, maybe like he saw us right here and then just jumped way down off the hill. So we made like a bigger circle around where there was no snow and nothing. And so, I mean, I was perplexed. We were all perplexed. It was me and this guy's name was Albert. And I remember like literally looking up in this pine tree, like, I don't even know where else this thing could have went. There's one track in and nothing coming out. And about, I don't know, 10 yards back from where the dirt started, there was like some thick new growth pines that we sort of had to like push our way through. And even though I had seen the track going from those two there, I was like, well, maybe we missed something. So I go back and I'm looking and I'm like, no, sure as heck, there's only one deer track out of there in here and there's blood in it. So it's his track and nothing like turned around going the other way. So anyway, I get in there and I look downhill, and downhill like 5 yards, I see the top of the pine trees, like little new growth pine. Off this steep hill, all the snow's knocked off of it. So I'm like, okay, I don't remember seeing that when we were on his track, like looking at the blood. I had my head down going through here and was like on it. So I get back there and I'm like, huh, that's kind of weird. That I, you know, nothing would have really knocked that off. So I like push through the new growth and look, and like 150 yards bedded down on the ridge is that buck laying there, like watching his back track. Laying on the ridge, looking right at that patch of new growth. So when I popped out, I mean, he was right there looking at me, and I just kind of like sunk back in and was like, Albert, get over here. And he came down there, popped out, shot him, finished him. But like that deer wound, like hit in the shoulder in fresh snow, 100% new, like walked into there and then backed up in his own tracks. You know, didn't even make a second set of tracks backing up, same exact hoof prints into that new growth, and then didn't just like walk that way, like jumped way down the hill as to like not leave a track. But luckily there was that snow on the top of those trees that gave it away, and we got him. But that day proved to me that every story, every probably myth you've heard of what deer will do is probably not too far off, because what I've, you know, whether people believe the story, whether they don't, I know what I saw, and it changed my opinion on what those big deer will do, even like in a distressed situation. It was unbelievable. So yeah, that day changed the way I look at the way mule deer may get away, or the tactics that they have in their toolkit if they need them.
Like you said, I mean, that is nearly unbelievable. I believe it because it's coming from you, but it just goes to show, like, if you are tracking a hit animal or you're trying to find something, you know, don't be afraid to kind of like think a little bit outside the box. And obviously, like, you got an amazing lesson there. I was actually extremely fearful that you were going to let me know that they'd learned to climb trees. And then I'm like, that's it. I'll never kill one. But it's over. They win.
No, it was, like you say, I mean, it's definitely not just mule deer, but any animal. I mean, you think like, oh, they're hit. They're in this train of thought of only, you know, going one way, and they're not thinking clearly or whatever. Like, it was an eye opener for sure. I mean, this deer was, yeah. And it's still to this day, one of the coolest mule deer I've ever been able to like walk up to. And that story, like, I respect him as much as any deer I've personally taken because of what he put us through. Is pretty unbelievable.
I mean, yeah, that is super cool. And like you said, the way you described that buck, I mean, it sounds like the thing, you know, a buck out of basically all I've ever seen it is in like an artist renderings of what this, like, you know, crazy perfect, you know, like you said, 10 by 10 non-typical double dropper, like, oh my gosh, like, I don't think it gets better than that. So
yeah, he was gorgeous. Big extra cheaters and big dark horn mountain buck. Yeah, just a beautiful deer. Not a very old deer either.
No kidding.
Yeah, he wasn't super old. I mean, if I had to guess, I would say he was probably 4.5, 5.5, maybe at the most. Just didn't have a big Roman nose, didn't have that big mature looking mule deer face on him yet.
Interesting. Switching gears here, maybe back to gear in a way. We like to kick the old cartridge hornet's nest around here. Now, Jason, you strike me as a guy that's like, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You got a cartridge of choice for chasing these big bucks around?
Yeah. So my favorite caliber of all time has always been a 270. I shot my first elk with the 270, my first bear. I've, you know, since then taken pretty much every animal in North America with a 270, other, you know, with the exception of a few critters up north, like a Kodiak or Alaskan moose and some stuff like that. But yeah, I just love the caliber. You know, it's an easy to find cartridge in small towns across the, well, you know, as easy to find of cartridge. Today's a little different than it was, you know, a few years ago, but either way, it's, if you run out of ammo, you forget your ammo, you end up in some little small town in Montana, you know, chances are the little hardware store there probably has a box of 270 ammo. So I love its performance, and I love, just the, you know, the fact that it's a pretty classic caliber. It's a lot of, you know, my hunting, icons growing up were a fan of that. And so, yeah, that's my go-to. I hunt elk with that. I hunt spring bear with that. I hunt mule deer, whitetail, kind of whatever with that caliber.
It is. You can't go wrong with it. I mean, that is a tried and true, iconic, just great all-around cartridge. So, yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's funny. I've killed one deer with a 270, but I don't know why. I think it's just because I have a couple .6s, and then I've been shooting that 300 short for quite a few years now. But I sprinkle in a few other cartridges here and there. But, man, my dad shot a 270 growing up. My grandpa shot a 270. Like you said, deer, elk, bears, whatever. It was, you know, it did the job. And like you said, you know, Jack O'Connor touted the effectiveness of the 270, and he wasn't lying. You know, we're talking about, you know, finding these things, you know, shooting them. You got your 270, so now you got one. Let's eat this thing, Jason. What's your go-to, like, man, my number one mule deer recipe or meal that I'm going to make is this?
Well, for mule deer, so I kind of have a system down with my different wild game throughout the year to sort of keep a nice selection in the freezer for the year. Mule deer, I normally do mostly all my brats with mule deer. So I will do everything from a smoked German sausage to a jalapeno cheddar brat to a smoked cheddarman to, you know, a bunch of different selections of bratwurst. My boys love bratwurst. Plus, you know, you get buddies up shooting bows or whatever. You just want to throw something on the grill. Super easy, you know. So for me, I don't have really a recipe with mule deer that is a go-to sort of secret family recipe on that. But it definitely, from some breakfast sausage type stuff to brats, is what sort of keeps that selection of my freezer filled every year. Whereas, like, you know, antelope, I do a lot of my snack sticks, like jerky, pepperoni sticks, things like that I do out of antelope. My elk is all my burger and my steaks. And then, you know, bear, if I get one, a lot of times I'll do just more of like a, this last bear I did like a spicy chorizo and like an Italian breakfast sausage with my bear. So yeah, from sort of kind of breakfast, lunch to dinner to everything in between, if I kind of break everything down like that, it really is a good system for me that works well to feed my little family.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a good balance and a good system. And I will point out, you know, you're looking at a, you know, nice big mule deer buck, you know, that's, you know, probably about 100 pounds of brats, Jason. Are you sure you're not from Wisconsin?
Well, as you know, I like to throw wild game barbecues too throughout the year. So I do a big one every year called the Hunter Harvest. And so, you know, a lot of my wild game every year goes to my family and friends. I just love to have people out, tell stories, gather around the birch barrel, grill some stuff up and shoot our bows, that kind of thing. So yeah, I share a lot.
That's awesome. Well, so we've talked about on the front end of this thing, we talked about all the great content, hunting content that you make. We've talked about all about mule deer and how to hopefully find and bring one of these things to bag. We've talked about eating them, and we just kind of talked about, you know, sharing and camaraderie and people, which all these things tied together brings me to one of your latest pieces that's going to be a Vortex Select. It's going to hit on our website kind of in conjunction with this podcast. We're going to tie them together, put a neat little bow on them. But really, really awesome story that you and some friends put together. So maybe talk/tease a little bit about that whole story, because it's a really cool one. It's fun to watch, action packed, and really, in my opinion, captures the essence of a mule deer hunt.
For sure. Yeah. I certainly can't begin to take the credit for this project. It was a group effort between myself, Willie Schmidt from Peer Hunting, and then Nick Ventura from Become One and their crew over there. I mean, basically where it all started from was we wanted to put together a camp. Nick wanted to come mule deer hunting out in Montana. So we wanted to do kind of a traditional camp, get those guys out here, kind of show them the rutting mule deer experience, being from, you know, the eastern part of the country. They've never really experienced that. And so wanting to share that, I invited them up. I had met a ranching family a year previous to that when I was out deer hunting, that we actually stopped to just see if this lady needed help on the side of the road. We were kind of down and out hunting that day. We were trying to find where other guys weren't hunting, and out in the middle of nowhere, ran into this lady, stopped and asked if she needed help. She said that she didn't. She was just kind of the middleman with some coffee and some sandwiches for some cowboys that were moving cattle through. And so we got to talking, connected the dots. I actually knew some people she knew, just kind of small town Montana stuff, and went to leave. And she asked us, she said, "Are you guys hunting?" And I said, "Yeah, we are." And she goes, "Are you having any luck?" And I said, "Well, you know, we're seeing some deer, but we just got here last night. So we're just trying to feel where other hunters aren't, other guys are, you know, camps are, that kind of stuff." And she said, "Well, if you'd like, my husband's up at the ranch. Feel free to go up and talk to him. There's nobody hunting our ranch, and you'd be welcome to hunt there the next few days." And so, you know, we were blown away. We hadn't asked. we hadn't implied that that's what we wanted, nothing. And she opened her doors. Then she continued to offer us to stay in this cabin that they had built off of lumber, off the property that her grandma had built. And we had a wall tent set up on the ridge, so we, you know, didn't stay in the cabin. But anyway, long story short, I've continued to keep in touch with these people and become good friends with them. And so I thought, man, that'd be the perfect place to take Nick. And in the meantime, Willie ended up wanting to join on the hunt. So Willie coming out, and yeah, so brought those guys out, shared with them this spot that had been so graciously opened up to myself and some other friends the year before, and took them out there. And like you say, it had all those elements of the traditional deer hunt. And you had, you know, the old cabin in this really cool kind of drainage on the ranch that had this old meat pole on it. And, you know, so it had this sort of just cool feel of coming back to camp every day. Like, you know, you'd see the pictures in the past of the deer hanging on the meat pole and everybody out there looking at them. And every day you'd come back and, you know, as soon as you'd clear the corner looking at the camp, you'd see if there was another deer hanging on the meat pole. And I won't give it away, but, you know, the hunt couldn't have went much more smooth from beginning to end. We had a blast, and, you know, I think we started a new tradition there. And so we're happy to share it through Vortex and through the Selects. Yeah, it just, it went great. And yeah, they're coming back here in a couple weeks, and we're going to do it again.
Dude, that's awesome. I think that tells the tale too, as far as like, yep, let's do it again. And yeah, this the quintessential deer camp and the camaraderie and, you know, a team effort and a meat pole that you hopefully fill up. I mean, it doesn't get too much better than that. So I am excited to hear how this year's story unfolds, and I'm excited to hear actually how your afternoon unfolds. We need to let you get out of here. So it seems like every time we talk to you, you're getting ready. You're in the middle of hunting, so we pull you away. So, but yeah, excited to see how this afternoon goes for you. We're actually taking some new hunters out today, so that should be really fun here at Vortex. Oh. So we'll see if we can't find us a buck or a doe this afternoon. So
we're heck yeah, well, that'll be fun.
Yeah, really looking forward to it. It's been a fun experience for me personally, and a fun process, just kind of exposing a person to the world of hunting, and you know, hearing the questions that they have, and hopefully being able to answer those questions and let some see some of the things that we have seen kind of unfold in front of their eyes. So, but yeah, all good stuff, and hopefully more great experiences to come. Jace, oh boy,
see that's that. That's that mule deer I was telling you about that pulled the sneak attack on us there in the snow and backed up in his own tracks. That's a super old photo of a photo.
Dude, that thing is phenomenal. If you're watching on YouTube and you can see Jason's screen, he is showing me one of the coolest bucks I have ever seen. That thing, the horns on that thing has more twists and turns than the story you told about it. That thing is awesome.
Yeah, so.
Well, now I'm really pumped to get outside, Jason. So we're going to let you go. Thank you again for everything that you do. Thank you for the time. Always enjoy chatting. Hopefully we'll get to see each other here in the near future at some point in time. That's always a pleasure. And yeah, take care and good luck out there, man.
Yeah, appreciate it, Mark. And appreciate you giving me a chance to chat with you here. And yeah, for anybody listening, I definitely recommend you watch the Vortex Selects. It's just a four-part series, starts with my hunt, goes to Nick's, Willie's, and then a wrap-up, and just a great, unique project we had the chance to collaborate on. And I know, speaking for everyone here, the guys from Become One, Peer Hunting, and myself, we're very excited to share this and just really thank Vortex for giving us the opportunity and a platform to share it with everyone. So just excited to hear the feedback.
Oh man, all the thanks on our end. Yeah, it is a good one. Check it out. So yeah, you can check that out on the Vortex YouTube channel. And before we close it out, Jason, I know we've closed it out like three times. This is a classic Wisconsin goodbye, by the way. We do this. We just keep it going. What about where else can people find you real quick? All the other great content that you're kicking out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm on Instagram. I'm pretty active on there at Jason Matzinger Official. That is also my Facebook handle, Instagram and Facebook. I'm on Sportsman's Channel every Monday night. It's 7:30 Mountain Time, 9:30 Eastern Time. Those are our prime time slots. That's when we kick out the new episodes every week. If you miss Mondays, we come on four more times throughout the week. I don't know those off the top of my head. But yeah, as well as intohighcountry.com. And, you know, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation's website has a ton of the conservation work on there, as well as wild sheep and mule deer. So kind of spread out, but love hearing from people, love getting feedback, good or bad. It's I really enjoy what I do and feel honored to get the opportunity to do it. So
awesome. Appreciate that. Well, you hear that, everybody? You can find Jason in all these places, but actually the place you're most likely to find him is out in the field, which is where you're headed right now. So go out there. Good luck. And we'll talk soon. All right, that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Vortex Nation podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you like what you hear, hit that subscribe button, give us a review, or leave a comment. We want to hear what you have to say. If you have a question or topic suggestion, let us know that as well via the Vortex Nation podcast YouTube page or any of Vortex's social platforms. That helps us cover exactly what you want to hear so we can provide the best information to help you with your hunting, shooting, and related activities, and ultimately enjoy them to their fullest potential. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you on the next one.